Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you're listening to New Books in British History, a channel on the New Books Network. To our eyes, 18th century Britain can look like a world of opposites. On one hand, everything was new. Political parties and a prime minister emerged in parliament. Their antics were recorded by an expanding political press, whose products were read and debated in London's many coffee houses. The Enlightenment began in Scotland and unleashed new ideas about natural law, natural rights, and the perfectibility of society that drove the great democratic revolutions. On the other hand, the 18th century was defined by the survival of the old. For some historians, power continued to be channeled through the institutions of the ancien regime, the monarchy, the church, and the aristocracy. But that world was changing. Public opinion and public attention turned to other places, namely Britain's expanding global empire that brought new goods, fresh ideas, and very diverse peoples into British consciousness. Ryan Hanley is British Academy postdoctoral fellow and a senior research associate in history at the University of Bristol. In Beyond Slavery and Abolition, Black British Writing, he seeks to shift the focus of Black history away from slavery and abolition and towards something more complex. In a series of beautifully turned intellectual and cultural biographies, he reveals the contribution of Black writers to politics, culture, and the arts in 18th century Britain, helping it along the way to becoming modern. Ryan Hanley joins me from Bristol. Ryan, it's great to talk to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is your first book, and congratulations. I wonder if you can tell us about how you framed the project and the journey that the book and you took from turning this from a doctoral thesis into a first published book.
So the journey of this book began even before I started doing my PhD. So I sort of first encountered some of the questions that I'm trying to answer in the book as an undergraduate. And so during my second year of my undergraduate degree in English literature, I was given a research project to do. And one of the options on the list of projects was find out a little bit more about James Albert, Eucorsor, Groniosor. And I thought, well, this is a name that I've absolutely never heard of. Who is this person? It turns out he's the first ever published Black author in Britain, and we knew very, very little about him. So I went off as a second-year undergrad and did a little bit of archival research, and I was lucky enough to find a manuscript letter by Groniosor that had been misfiled in an archive in Cambridge and had never been kind of allocated to Groniosor. So that was the sort of my first taste of historical research, of proper kind of archival research. But it was also interesting to see that in that letter, Groniosor is taking an interest in things that are beyond slavery and abolition. He's not just talking about slavery in the way that all of the kind of secondary literature seemed to suggest that he would be. He was talking about religion and found religion to be more important than the question of slavery. So I pursued that sort of thread of research into the Black intellectual presence during this period, all the way through the Masters, and then I did a PhD on the subject, which brought together a group of these authors. I guess for me, the biggest kind of step in the journey from taking it from a PhD thesis and turning that into a book was actually the move away from the kind of exactitude and precision of an exam piece into making some bolder claims about the significance of these authors and their centrality to a whole range of issues. So in a PhD thesis, you know, you're encouraged to be to hedge your bets a little bit and to couch the sort of claims that you're making in very cautious terms. Whereas in a book, I think that you need to stand up for yourself a little bit more and to make strong claims. And in my case, that's about the significance and the importance of these Black intellectuals to a whole range of British social, cultural, and political history.
So there's some excellent advice for any PhD students who are listening to us. Be safe, then be bold later. So you mentioned, I mean, this goes back to your undergraduate. So can you take us through the process? You encountered Gronyasov very early on, but how did the process of choosing authors take place? I mean, how did you choose them? Why did you choose them? Which ones were well known? Which ones were obscure? And we'll come back to specific examples in a second. But I think just more broadly speaking, how did these people come to your attention?
Well, in some ways, it was a relatively easy process because I knew I wanted to work on the late 18th, early 19th centuries. It was just the period that had always kind of held my interest the most. And it's also the period that overlaps with the abolition movement. So the period 1770 to 1830 was my kind of starting point. And there's actually a very small pool of published Black British writing to emerge during that period. There's a bit more if you take into account the whole Atlantic world. So there's American authors alongside there that aren't in the book because they've been slightly better covered by the existing literature. As a PhD student, my kind of main thing that I wanted to do was everyone except Equiano, because Olaude Equiano is such a well-known figure and that there's actually been quite a lot written about him and his contribution, largely to the anti-slavery movement, it should be said, but there's a little bit of acknowledgement that he was an important political figure in his own right. Now, when I went to turn that into a book, I added a chapter on Equiano, partly because that's what people want to read about, partly because it's a good way to kind of introduce people who might have only encountered Olaude Equiano and the interesting narrative. It's a good way to kind of draw people in from that position into this whole kind of range, this whole constellation of Black intellectual stars in Britain at the time. So the specific authors that I'm covering in this book it's a good test if I can remember all eight, Eucorso Gronyoso. The next one is Ignatius Sancho. The third author is Otobar Caguano. The fourth is Olaude Equiano. The fifth is Boston King. The sixth is John Jay. The seventh is Robert Wedderburn. And the eighth is Mary Prince. So those are in chronological order.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're going to deal with a group of those later on. We don't have the time to go through the whole lot of them. On one level, this book is a series, as I said in the introduction, of sort of intellectual cultural biographies where you sort of position these people. And the second layer of interpretation in the book, which I think is really compelling and interesting, is the focus that you place on networks. And you divide your networks into sort of three types. There's networks of celebrity, networks of evangelicals, religious networks, and then finally, networks of radicals, political radicals. How did they find their way onto and into these networks?
Yeah, so the way that I've divided the book up is in these three kind of categories of networks. And that's the way that I try to situate the Black intellectual presence into a broader picture of British history during this period. So the first part of the book is called Black Celebrities, and that's Ignatius Sancho, Eladio Equiano, and Mary Prince. The argument of that section is that black authors kind of use their social networks, and their social networks to an extent use them to make them famous or well-known within Britain, even for a very short time. And I guess one of the key kind of intellectual questions of the book is about the tension between the agency of the authors themselves and the ways in which their networks are attempting to frame their message to get between us and the authors, if you see what I mean. So in terms of the celebrity networks, they're quite diverse. I think that Equiano is the individual who has the kind of strongest sense of control over how his personal image is being represented. I think that's something he's really good at, and I guess we can talk about that a bit more later. In the case of somebody like Mary Prince, because she has that kind of intersectional identity of being a black woman author, the tension is weighted slightly differently. I think that she possibly has slightly less authorial control over how she's being represented. So the celebrity section is quite a diverse one. And then Ignatius Sancho, his letters weren't published until after he died. So it's a totally different dynamic there as well. In terms of evangelicalism, that's really the kind of starting point for black life writing in being published in Britain. Black authors are kind of drawn into pre-existing evangelical networks, but they choose to kind of navigate them. And in some ways, they're the most internationalist of the types of networks that we're looking at. But in other ways, they're also the most tightly controlled in terms of the form that the narratives take and the focus of them, because they're always obviously very heavily focused on the kind of spiritual experience. So the way that black authors enter the evangelical networks tends to be through a kind of conversion experience. And then finally, the politically radical networks, so that I'm focusing on Ottobre Caguano and Robert Wedderburn for that section. That's the area for me that sees the most kind of authorial agency and control, because the way that we define radicalism is in a sense kind of as a negative to hegemonic or, you know, kind of mainstream political culture. That means that the black intellectuals working in those networks aren't kind of so dependent on their networks financially or in terms of spreading their texts around or distributing their texts, because they could start to build those networks in an underground way. So those are some of the most challenging authors to research, because obviously they're sometimes doing things that are not legal, so they're not always recorded consistently. But I think they're also the most rewarding kind of authors to look at, because you get to see what you really want to see, which is black authors having sort of full control over their creative process, over what they're saying and how they're saying it.
The notion of full control is interesting, and I just want to pick up on something that you said in that last answer, and that's the question of agency. Are these writers in the pure sense, that is to say, autonomous people creating texts and putting them out into the public marketplace on their own terms, or are the texts that we see today the product of other things? And you answer this question in the book. You talk about transcription, edition, mediation, and other things. How did these processes work? How were these texts produced?
So I think one of the key challenges about working on this body of primary materials, this body of writing, is that many of these authors were not literate or not literate enough to write down these life narratives, largely life narratives, without the assistance of an amanuensis or an editor or both. So there's instantly a methodological question that comes up in terms of research. You know, how do we use these texts? To what extent can we use these texts as kind of uncontaminated, perfect reflections of the Black experience, whatever that is, or the Black perspective, whatever that means? But the answer that I come to in the book in terms of mediation and transcription and edition is that maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe that's not what we should be using these texts for. Perhaps we should be thinking about how these texts came to be as they are, rather than trying to read them for what we wish they could be, as these kind of sort of pure and uncontaminated windows into the minds of 18th century Black intellectuals. So what I'm interested in is precisely what you just described, those processes of transcription, edition, intercession, and so on. I mean, in terms of the way that sort of leads into how we encounter the texts, then the other big question is distribution. And that sort of links in with the networks aspect of the writing. So how are these texts actually getting out there into the world? Now, in some cases, like in evangelical networks, that's quite easy to reconstruct because you can go to the publisher, and then you can go to big databases like 18th century collections online or something like that, see what else the publisher is producing, and then you can get a sense of when you go into a bookshop and you pick up this piece of Black writing by, you know, Grogniosaw, for example, what's next to it on the shelf? How is it being directed to a particular market, to a particular readership? And then what you can do is then reflexively use that to go back to the texts and look at why they're written as they are. So, you know, just as when you read a novel today, when you pick up my book, that's not just the work of one person. It's called a monograph, but it's not just one person's work. It's gone through the hands of editors. It's come to you through a publisher. It's come to you through a kind of form of transmission from something that I was thinking to something that you're holding in your hands and reading and interacting with as an artifact, as well as a kind of floating bit of text in the void. Those are kind of key questions that I'm interested in. They're basically slightly different for each of the authors. And as I mentioned before, radical distribution networks are harder to trace than evangelical ones, for instance. But that's a big part of the book, is to try to unpick how that works for each individual author.
You say in the acknowledgements that this book itself is the product of many hands, and that's true. And I suppose this recording is part of the book's story. So, in other words, there's really nothing terribly unusual going on in the 18th century with respect to these authors. This is normal for publication, or are these authors identified and selected by people who think that there could be money to be made here? Is there anything exploitative about this?
Well, the book is called Beyond Slavery and Abolition, but it doesn't sort of throw out the question of slavery altogether. My point here is that in many cases, the networks of edition and dissemination, transmission, are kind of keen to publicly associate themselves, in some cases, with the anti-slavery movement, or to make some kind of statement around the question of colonial slavery or anti-slavery. And often they will enthusiastically support the production or the promotion of a piece of writing by an African or somebody of African descent in order to make a bigger statement about slavery. So, for instance, if we look at the, I gave a talk last night, in fact, here in Bristol, about Boston King. And he composed his memoirs while he was staying at Kingswood School just outside of Bristol. And they were published a couple of years later at the precise time when the management committee of Kingswood School, Methodist Kingswood Committee, were really, really keen to make a statement about how abolitionist they were and how much they supported, you know, the ending of the slave trade, but also how abolition could be this very politically moderate thing. And the reason they wanted to do that is because they were keen to make good connections with the administration through the abolitionist William Wilberforce. He was their contact with the kind of Pitt government. So that's just, you know, one example of how a network very carefully controls the publication and distribution of a particular text, because they held onto it for 2 years after it was completed before publishing it. Of how they control that kind of process in order to kind of further their own goals. Now, I'm not sure that I would necessarily frame that as straightforwardly exploitative. The way that I think of it is as a tension between authorial agency, the degree of control that an author could have over a text, even if they couldn't write it or control the publication process. But the tension between that and, on the other hand, the goals and aims of the network that surrounded that author and that text as it was published.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, thanks. That's very clear. And so I think what we want to do now is sort of turn to discuss four of the writers that you deal with in the book. And I want to begin, you've mentioned already Equiano, obviously the most famous, the interesting narrative is available, I think, as a Penguin classic, and it's taught all over the place, certainly here and in North America. So tell anybody who is listening to this who doesn't know who Equiano is, who is he, and what does he write about, and why is he important?
So, Olaudah Equiano, also known as Gustavus Vassa, is probably the most famous African or person of African descent in 18th century Britain and probably in the world in the 18th century, with the possible exception, I suppose, of the African-American poet Phyllis Wheatley. Now, Equiano, as I argue in the book, I think really the main reason that Equiano is so famous, is so, so well known, is because his 1789 autobiography, The Interesting Narrative, is an explicitly and straightforwardly abolitionist, anti-slavery piece of polemic. To try to give a potted biography of Equiano is quite difficult because he led such an extraordinary life. He was involved in a voyage to the Arctic. He was involved in an abortive slave trading operation on the Mosquito Shore. He traveled absolutely everywhere around Britain promoting his book, and also promoting a particular kind of image of himself as a kind of commodified personality. So he would go on speaking tours and give lectures and basically promote himself and his autobiography as a kind of commercial product. So what I think is really important about Equiano is that he helps to develop the modern idea of what a celebrity is, the idea of a personality that you can consume as an audience member or a participant, and feel that you can kind of engage with the product of Olauda Equiano. And that's one of the reasons that he has these two names, Gustavus Vassa, which he uses in his private correspondence, and Olauda Equiano, the celebrity abolitionist, which is the title of the chapter in the book about him.
So, yeah, Equiano is someone who reminds me, there are other people in the Atlantic that Linda Cawley, for example, has written about, people who move around the Atlantic world from place to place, and they turn up in unusual places and cut across a whole series of networks and situations and contexts. Groniasaw reminds me somewhat of work that Natalie Zeman Davis did about trickster travels, where you have people coming sort of, broadly speaking, from one very different world into another. Tell us about Groniasaw.
Yeah, so Groniasaw is, as I mentioned earlier, he's the first published Black author in Britain. He is very firmly somebody who's interested in the idea of the predestination of the elect. That's the kind of core driving point behind his book. But perhaps I should go back a little bit and give a bit more of a biography of him. So Groniasaw was born in Borno, now in Nigeria, which is in the area that's now called Nigeria. And he was kidnapped as a child and sold on the Gold Coast, transported to New York, where he worked in as a domestic slave in some of the most important evangelical households, or households of the evangelical Dutch Reformed Church. So this is during what's called the Second Great Awakening in America, the kind of massive explosion of evangelical Protestantism across North America. So Groniasaw came of age in that kind of milieu. He met some of the most significant Calvinist preachers, including George Whitfield, Theodorus Frelinghuysen, and other kind of Calvinist or Dutch Reformed bigwigs, basically. And then upon kind of gaining his freedom, he took part in the Seven Years' War. I think it's called the French and Indian War for North American listeners. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Just to translate there.
It used to be called that, but I think we're trying to figure out a new name. I think Seven Years' War is back in. But
oh, okay. All right. Well, anyway, Groniasaw participated in the Seven Years' War for the British side. And he took part in the capture of Havana and a number of other kind of key incidents that allow us to kind of put a bit of a chronology on his life. And then in about the mid-1760s, he made it over to Britain, where he married an English woman. And then the last sort of part of his life was marked by this kind of impoverished itinerancy around various different rural parts of Britain, Norwich and Brecknockshire and Herefordshire and places that are just, you know, nowhere near London or nowhere near some of the kind of key urban centres of the period. So he gives us a sort of a perspective both on how a spiritual autobiography works, but also on what it's like to be very, very poor in rural Britain and to be moving around in search of work.
So he's the opposite of Equiano, essentially.
Yeah, so absolutely. So Groniasaw is, in terms of his personality, he's very kind of self-effacing. He downplays a lot of the things that happened to him that most of us as scholars would instantly be able to ascribe to racial prejudice. For instance, having being swindled out of money by unscrupulous kind of white people during his travels in Britain. So that's a sort of potted biography. But one of the things that's most striking and most unexpected about Groniasaw is that his autobiography is not just very quiet about the issue of slavery, but it seems to support the idea that his enslavement was beneficial to him because it helped him to convert to Christianity. And part of the project of that I did, I've worked on Grunion Soul for 10 years now, but for me, I think the key for him is that Calvinist theology demands that you understand and know the word of God, but that you are either predestined to go to heaven or you're not, that you're either one of the elect or you're not, and that you don't need to have any sort of bodily freedom to do that. You only need to be converted. Now, what that means in terms of slavery is that slavery is a kind of benevolent, enslaving somebody is a kind of benevolent act as long as you Christianize them. And that just so happened to match up with the goals and aims of Gronioso's network of patrons, including the dedicatee of the autobiography, Selina Hastings, the Countess of Huntingdon. So she was a slave-owning patron of Gronioso.
So we crossed then the Atlantic, the opposite side, and we're in Bermuda. It's 1788, and Mary Prince is born into slavery, and then is loses her family at the age of 10, and then goes on. Very similar to at least the linking theme here is movement. Where does she go from there, and how does she find her way to Britain and into print?
So Mary Prince is an equally kind of mobile figure, although she spends much of her time traveling from island to island in the British Caribbean. So she works on three or four different islands. One thing I think is interesting about Prince is that she undertakes unfree labor in ways that are quite different to what we might imagine as the kind of typical form of plantation slavery. So we might think of tobacco fields or cotton fields or sugar plantations. But what Mary Prince shows in her experiences show is that slave labor is actually an extremely diverse kind of phenomenon. It takes in quite a lot of different experiences. So for instance, she works harvesting sea salt, which was a horrible job. It was extremely bad for you. It's very bad for your skin. And she talks about the physical effects of that type of slavery in quite graphic detail. But for the majority of her life, she's working as a domestic slave, undertaking domestic labor, clothes washing, working as a kind of maid to the house, to the slave owners, basically. It's not until 1828 that she comes to Britain with her kind of latest set of slave owners, John and Mary Wood. At that point, because of the Mansfield ruling which is 1772 ruling, that basically allows enslaved people to leave enslavement and not be compelled to return to slavery if they're within mainland Britain. She ends up leaving slavery. She emancipates herself once she gets to Britain, in effect, and travels around London and eventually enters the service of Thomas Pringle, who's a secretary of the Anti-Slavery Society in London. And it's while she's living there, so she's working as a maid and living with Thomas Pringle, and it's while she's living there that she composes her life narrative, The Life of Mary Prince. One thing I think is particularly tricky, and this goes back to what you were saying about the mediation and the intercession and addition, is that Mary Prince's published narrative has this very, very heavy framing by Pringle. So Pringle has edited down the text that has not been written by Prince directly. It's been written down by an amanuensis called Susanna Strickland. So Pringle has very heavily edited this text. And in the introduction, he says, I have trimmed and pruned this text into its present shape to make it more agreeable to the reader, or something along those lines. And throughout the text, he keeps interceding. He keeps making his presence known with little footnotes to what she's saying. So she might use the expression, the slang bakra, and then you'll get him saying, this is a West Indian expression. It means white man. And then you get even more egregious intercessions in the text that say things like, this next paragraph is taken down very nearly from Mary's own words. And that leaves you thinking, well, what's the rest of this narrative then if it's not taken down very nearly from Mary's own words?
So you can see the process of the text being shaped right there, essentially.
Yeah, so it's this almost like Brechtian process where you can absolutely see this really heavy scaffolding that Pringle's keen to erect around the text so that you read it in the desired way, you know, that there's one correct way to interpret Mary Prince's experiences, and that's in the way that's most beneficial to the anti-slavery society. So again, it's a really interesting challenge, and it's a really interesting exercise for me anyway, and it's something I've tried to draw out quite a lot in the book, to identify that tension between what Mary Prince may have been saying in the first instance as a verbal, ephemeral kind of process, and what we get in this kind of very heavily mediated, edited text with Pringle's fingerprints all over it.
You mentioned early on the third network, radicalism, harder to trace. Now, Robert Wedderburn is a major figure in that context, and I'm really struck in the book where you begin by talking about the potential roots of his radical outlook, and you take us back to a point when he's 4 years old and he sees his mother being tied down and flogged while she's pregnant. Can you tell us how he uses that obvious anger and where that comes in and shapes his ideas?
Yeah, so Robert Wedderburn is one of the most interesting, I think one of the most charismatic, and he was at the time seen as one of the most dangerous political radicals in Britain. And he was up against quite a bit of stiff competition because he was writing during the kind of high point of insurrectionary British radicalism. And he absolutely himself, always throughout his entire life until a few years before he died, attributed that kind of anger and his kind of anti-establishment impulses towards those that childhood trauma of seeing the injustice of unchecked power by seeing his heavily pregnant mother being tied to the ground and flogged. So Wedderburn comes to Britain in the late 1780s as a teenager, having served in the Royal Navy, which is another very common kind of experience for the male authors in this book. The Royal Naval Service is a big kind of factor of migration to Britain, certainly for these authors. It's a big common experience for them. So Wedderburn comes to Britain in the 1780s. He's interested, first of all, in Methodism by his account, but then he kind of gets a bit jaded and a little bit fed up with the infighting that's typical of Methodism during the 1790s. There's a lot of breaks in that religious movement. And so, like a lot of former service people in the 1790s, he's kind of brought into, or he first encounters this radical underworld of people operating right on the fringes of legal society and often spilling over into illegal activities. And he becomes involved with a group called the Spencians. So he's under the influence of a well-established radical called Thomas Spence. So So Spence's whole radical mindset is based around the redistribution of land, about removing kind of oligarchies and redistributing the land in an equitable way between everybody fairly, as a way to kind of break the tyranny and corruption of the British system. Now, what Wedderburn's really good at doing is taking that idea that land is the basis of inequality and transferring it and applying it to the Caribbean context. So even though he's in Britain, by the time we get to about 1817, Wedderburn's writing not just kind of polemics, but sort of fairly detailed plans about how enslaved people in the Caribbean can rise up, violently overthrow their masters, and then create this new Spencean utopia where everybody gets equal ownership of the land, and everybody has a kind of equal say in the way that the laws are administered and the way that government works, basically. So Wedderburn's a really, really significant link between this British story of political insurgency and the well-known story of slave resistance in the British Caribbean. Wedderburn's a key link between those two radical worlds, basically.
We've spoken about the approach of positioning some of these authors, and I mean, the question that emerges, we've talked about agency and the mediation of texts and the circumstances around their production. And I'm aware that every case in the book is slightly different. But if we could sort of step back a bit and think of them more broadly, are these people what specialists in post-colonialism would call the subaltern? That is, are they outside and underneath colonial and imperial power? Or do the networks that you reconstruct bring them into those structures of power?
Yeah, so I think some post-colonial theorists, and I guess the famous one is Gyatri Spivak, are quite pessimistic about whether we can recover a kind of subaltern voice. Can the subaltern speak? And Spivak's conclusion often is no, not really. We can't get those voices back. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether I fall down on one side of the argument or the other in terms of whether these texts represent a kind of subaltern speaking, as it were. But what I do think is interesting about the findings from this study, from this bit of research, is that actually the boundaries between the kind of subaltern and hegemonic worlds are maybe a little bit more porous than we think. We know that, so I've just described Robert Wedderburn, this incredible radical figure, but we do know that by the early 1830s, Wedderburn is actually arguing against the abolition of slavery itself. So he's arguing that we should be working towards a very gradual kind of system whereby individual enslaved people are able to work and then purchase their own freedom on a case-by-case basis, which is totally out of step with what the abolitionists are doing. but in that sense, Wedderburn is kind of is moving away from the very radical position that's all about violent slave uprisings and overthrowing the system of colonial slavery, towards one which it's difficult for us to conclude is speaking for the interests of the kind of subaltern, is speaking for the interest of the enslaved, because he's talking about something very gradual. So I think that there is possibly more to it than that binary idea that African descended intellectuals during this period represent this kind of subaltern voice speaking. I think it's a more complicated and it's a sometimes more disturbing story than that.
I wonder, we're coming close to the end. I just have a couple of more questions left. And I guess the first one would be what we sometimes ask PhD students, which is the so what question. What is this, the overall significance, the takeaway? You mentioned at the beginning that the process of revising the book, you were looking to make bold claims. What is the bold claim you want to make in this book?
So in a nutshell, it's that Black intellectuals weren't peripheral to British society, and they weren't only interested in this one facet of British society. They didn't just care about slavery and abolition. I think that's one way in which kind of the Black presence, and particularly the Black intellectual presence, has been kind of siloed off from mainstream narratives of British history. So what this book says is that Black intellectuals were right there at the centre of a whole range of movements, and that British history during this period is not just a kind of story about white people, nor is it a story about white people talking about Black people. Black intellectuals were absolutely central actors in these networks of power and in these movements and issues that were significant to everyone.
And finally, we historians never rest. You gave a talk last night. You're probably doing something right after this. I know I am.
Yep.
What am I keeping you from working on right now? What is the next project?
So the next project is a monograph, which is under the provisional title of Slavery in the British Working Class, 1787 to 1838. And it's a study of the relationship between political radicalism and the anti-slavery movements during that period, 1787 to 1838. And it's an attempt to understand how questions around labor and freedom helped to frame working class identity, and how the emergence of working class identity helped to frame the slavery debates.
That sounds like a great transition project. Ryan, I want to thank you for your time.
And thank you very much for having me.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you've been listening to New Books in British History, a channel on the New Books Network. And I've been speaking to Ryan Hanley from the University of Bristol. His book, Beyond Slavery and Abolition, Black British Writing, 1770 to 1830, is just out with Cambridge University Press.